Jayuradhamadhava Kunjabihari Jayuradhamadhava Kunjabihari Gopi Janabharavaha Girvare Rahari Gopi Janabharavaha Girvare Rahari Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Chiravana Chahari Yamuna Chiravana Chahari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabihari Gopi Jana Balava Girivara Rahari Gopi Jana Balava Girivara Rahari Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Chiravana Chahari Yamuna Chiravana Chahari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabihari
Jayam Vishnu Pad Paramaham Tapariviraja Asto Tarasata Shri Srimani's Divine Grace Sesi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Shri Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasati Goswami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Shri Shri Rarasana Ki Jai Shri Shri Krishna Balaram Ki Jai Shri Shri Gonitai Ki Jai Gora Premanandi Hari Hari Bo All glories to the assembled devotees All glories to the assembled devotees All glories to the assembled devotees All glories, all glories, Shri Shri Guru and Garanga, Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Just one thought I was having, looking out at the devotees that were chanting Jai Radha Madhava. Please take this in the right spirit. I think the Alacha community reminds me of a job I had in a factory once. Yeah. And the reason being, because now, you know, as we see in the recent years and ever more, we're seeing that it used to be the Hare Krishna movement, everybody was like, when I joined, the temple president was 24. And there was one devotee that joined who was 29. And after Sankirtan, he used to take hot showers. And we thought that was such a joke, that he was so old. He'd come back from Sankirtan, he had to take a hot shower to like limber up his aged limbs, right? You know, and now you sit and there's 1 year old, how old is he? Is it 12 months? 15 months, and grandfathers that are 42 or something like that. Something like that, yeah. So we have like this, so it reminds me of a factory, because I worked in this factory, and it was a brand new factory, and they were like, I don't know the proper term, but they were filling it up. So when I went there, like every worker was like a station, you know, you put this screw in here, and you put this part on here, and you did this there. So they were like, the line wasn't working yet. It was only a skeleton. It wasn't completely filled in. So we spent like 3 months just gradually filling it in so that every station had a tract, it was a tract effect, was built up to the point it was supposed to be. Previously, it was just there was a few pieces there. So ISKCON was kind of like that. There was a few pieces. There was a lot of brahmacharis and brahmacharinis that were, again, a mature age of 24. And then we kind of went, oh, now we have grihasthas. And it was like, whoa, grihasthas, that means children come. Oh, that's interesting, children come. You know, and then it was like, whoa, teenagers. Whoa, this is interesting, teenage Hare Krishnas. And it was like, wow, middle-aged Hare Krishnas. I remember we had like the 30th anniversary, you know, years ago, what, 96, right? And we tried to get some media coverage. It's like the Hare Krishna movement grows up, right? We have 45-year-old people now. You know, and then a few years later, it's like, whoa, gray hair, right? We actually have gray hair. There's gray-haired Hare. And now there's grandparents, and probably there's probably a few great-grandparents around. Maybe the Lacho, I don't know for sure. But are there? Okay, yeah. And lots of kids. It's like here. It's like there's kids, there's teenagers, there's young adults, you know, there's older people. And it's really inspiring to see this is the unfolding of the movement. And of course, there's challenges at every one of those stages of life, but I think this community is doing a nice job, and we can always do better, and we should encourage others how to really demonstrate how at every stage of life it can be Krishna-focused. And that when people do that, then they can be happy. Just like I talked to Shyam on the way out the door, was wearing, I guess, scrubs, maybe not scrubs. He's a physical therapist. Thank you. Ooh. Do you have any different cup other than that for me? Yeah, I'd rather not, thanks. If you have something other than styrofoam, I'll take it. But otherwise, it's styrofoam. Yeah. I'm about ready to talk about the environment, so not with a styrofoam cup. I can't do that. But he was going to work. He's a physical therapist. I don't know if everybody here knows him, but I've never met him before. And he was telling me how he has some really deep conversations with people, because a lot of the people he sees, they're like on the end of life. And you know, I told him, you know, you can't go in there and say, you know, hi, I'm a Hare Krishna. I'm about to tell you what you should have done the last 72 years of your life. You can't be in that mood. But he said a lot of people, they're very open to hear about that. And I was thinking, what a beautiful job. You know, he can just tell people about Krishna as appropriate, where appropriate. You know, and somebody else, like driving a truck, like, you know, like, what's the devotee, I figured his name, I've known him for years, young guy. And he was telling me, he drives truck, and he tells him, I won't pull, sir, you got to tell me what's in that truck. I won't carry, you know, obviously meat, certain, I won't carry those. So how does that reverberate in the world out there? Does some like guy or lady like, yeah, you know, you're on a truck, get over to such and such. What's in that truck? What do you mean, what's in that truck? I'm not going to drive that truck. Guys, really, what things won't you? You know, it gets people thinking. So just, you know, I remember I became a devotee in Boulder, Colorado. That's my first kind of connected with devotees in Denver. And I can still see it. There was like two devotees walking down the street in Boulder. And from my, what I thought I saw, and to this day, at least the impression on me was they were like floating down the street. There was all these people kind of merging into the grayness of life. But then there were these two, and you know, they'd probably been around for 6 months, but compared to me, they were refulgent people. Thank you for being very kind. I'll get two. Wow, thank you. Very kind. You know, if they were floating on the street, and I think we sometimes don't realize the impact we have on people just like living in the world and being neighbors and, you know, in a gentle way, talking to people about the things we talk about. I'll just share this story and go to verse. Talk about in the communications course this wonderful story that Rabindranath Prabhu tells of in Philadelphia. I guess that they had a house. Chase is not here this morning. I think he was there in Philly. They had like a duplex house. So there was a little old lady lived next door to the devotees who were all, like we're saying, 18 to 20 years old and a little rambunctious. Prabhupada came and visited and he went for a morning walk. He walked down the sidewalk, I think left, turned left, right, whichever way, and did a U-turn, walked right back up to the porch because the little old lady was sitting on the porch. So Arvinda describes everybody gathered around to see, like, what's Prabhupada going to tell her? Like, you know, you only have a few days left. You know, your teeth are rotting and, you know, the whole thing, right? Right out of the Bhagavatam, right? Dhritarashtra and Vidura or something, you know. So they all gather. Arvinda Sup described, he said, I remember him saying, he said, it blew our minds. Prabhupada just talked old people talk. You know, and you might think, well, wait, Prabhupada, excuse me, Prabhupada, that was your chance to preach to that lady. Excuse me, Guru Maharaj, but like, you know, maybe like, you know, did what? So what was, you know, what was Prabhupada thinking? We can't know exactly, but in that time, place, and circumstance, making that friend relationship with that lady was, obviously he understood that was what he thought, what I think, because he thought it was the most important thing to do at that time. So in the same way, we don't necessarily always understand the impact that we can have. And that people notice us, you know, people really notice us. And of course, here in this community especially, but other places too, they notice. And it makes a difference. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
I think his name is going to be on the list someday. He's really attracted to that list. Just a few more years. So today we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, right? Chapter 4. Sorry, Chapter 6. I got a bunch of markers here. Chapter 6, it's this one. Chapter 6. Chapter 6, text 4, and I was told text 5, although there's purports for both. 4 and 5, okay. And we do the, well, okay, it's up here. Tadraikam vastu sharanam Shobhagasya chabhajanam Tvagasya sparsha vayoscha Sarva medhasya chayvahi Tadgatram vastu sharanam Shobhagasya chabhajanam Tvagasya sparsha vayoscha Sarva medhasya chayvahi Tadgatram vastu sharanam Shobhagasya chabhajanam Vagasya sparsha vayoscha Sarva medhasya chayvahi
Sarva
tat his gatram bodily surface vastu saranam of the active principles of all articles shobhagasya of all auspicious opportunities cha and bhajanam the field of production tvak skin asya his sparsha touch vayo of the moving airs cha also sarva all kinds of medhasya of sacrifices cha also eva certainly he exactly his bodily surface is the breeding ground for the active principles of everything and for all kinds of auspicious opportunities. His skin, like the moving air, is the generating center for all kinds of sense of touch and is the place for performing all kinds of sacrifice. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. The air is the moving agent of all the planets and as such, the generating centers for promotion to the deserving planets. The sacrifices are his bodily surface and are naturally the origin of all auspicious opportunities. Text 5, this one I'll just read myself. You can just listen, please. Brahmanyudhijatinam yarva yagyasta sambritaha keshasmanashunakyanyascha Shila lokabra vibhutam. The hairs on his body are the cause of all vegetation, particularly of those trees which are required as ingredients for sacrifice. The hairs on his head and face are reservoirs for the clouds, and his nails are the breeding ground of electricity, stones, and iron ores. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The polished nails of the Lord generate electricity, and the clouds rest on the hairs of his head. One can therefore collect all sorts of necessities of life from the person of the Lord. And therefore the Vedas affirm that everything that is produced is caused by the Lord. The Lord is the supreme cause of all causes. Omigana Tamiyandasha Janan Anjana Shalakaya Chakshu Immuntamina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Karadhar Srivasati Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare Hare. So, my first thought when I read the verse, I was thinking, yeah, yesterday I got to pick my own verse. The day before it was Chaitanya Charitamrita. I was thinking, I don't know that much about Lord Chaitanya's Leela. How am I going to do this? It was all about Krishna. It was like, boy, thank you. And today it was like, wow, I got one more to go. And it's like, the hairs on the Lord's head represent the causes of all vegetation. All kinds of things I have a lot of realization about. So I thought, okay, what the, how am I going to talk today? But then I was thinking, you know, went back and looked what was the previous verses and what are the chapters. And when you put things in context, it's actually quite fascinating. This particular canto, this sections, it begins with the first step in God realization. And in the little chapter breakdowns, it describes the very first section is hearing about Krishna Katha. So first thing, the first step in God realization. Then it goes to the Lord in the heart, which is a whole lot of things there, but much of it talks about how yogis meditate on the Lord in the heart and what their vision is and what they're focusing their attention on. Then the next chapter is pure devotional service, which is a really beautiful chapter. I'd kind of forgotten that was in the second canto. There's such it, and it's such a beautiful description of the process of bhakti. And you kind of get this sense like, okay, great, the book's done. It just comes, you know, you got to surrender to Krishna. He's the source of everything and everything is focused in him. And love of God is the highest perfection. And then it goes to creation. You know, back to creation and the descriptions we're hearing here. And also it's interesting in this section, Maharaj Parikshit is inquiring from Sukadeva Goswami, but then also Shonaka is inquiring from Sutta Goswami, and then there's a reference, Narada is inquiring from Brahma. So there's all these conversations within conversations that, of course, are there within the Bhagavatam. And also just struck me as I was reviewing it, every one of them, before they began to speak, it was like, so when Maharaj Parikshit asked the question of Sukadeva Goswami, he goes, well, let me begin by offering my obeisances, and then he just offers all these prayers. And you're kind of thinking like, well, can we get the answer, please? You know, and then they'll reference, okay, and then, you know, and then Shonaka is asking a question, and Sutta starts with, let me offer my offers with prayers. And Narada Muni asked Brahma, just before this is what's being referenced, and Brahma starts with prayers. Before I start, let me offer my obeisances unto the Lord and the Lord's representatives and like that. So I thought that was very instructive, because, you know, we understand we should always feel ourselves a fool before our spiritual masters. And especially here is, you know, before we try to say anything, we should really be thinking, how can I say anything? I have to offer my base. I not have to. I'm blessed to offer my basis to all these great personalities by whom only I have a little bit of insight at all. And let me just try to share some things I've learned from them. So Brahma's in that mood, and Sukadeva Goswami's in that mood, and Sutta Goswami's in that mood. And of course, later Narada's in that mood, etc. So then the question arose for me, why is it after this beautiful section, 2-3 chapters just before this, then why does it go back to creation? Why does it go back to what are kind of, I mean, I don't think most of us get really excited when we come in and we hear these verses, right? I mean, we just got through singing Dhammadharashtika. It's like, yeah, Krishna's, his mother of Yashoda ties him up, and if the rope's 2 fingers too short, and isn't that cute? And, you know, our hearts all melt. And then it's like the universal form. Like, oh, man, you know? Like, probably, couldn't you condense it a little bit for us? You know, did you have to, like, do the whole Bhagavatam? You know, maybe, these parts are kind of, like, not so interesting. But why are they here? And why did Parikshit Maharaj ask questions? He's to continue this line of thought. So as you flip through it, it's quite interesting. So I'm going to kind of jump around and hopefully find these different parts that I noted here. So in the fourth chapter, we're in the sixth chapter, but in the fourth chapter, text 6, this is Maharaj Parikshit's question leading to what we're reading now. He says to Sukadeva Goswami, I beg to know from you how the personality of Godhead, by his personal energy, creates these phenomenal universes as they are, which are inconceivable even to the great demigods. So he particularly asks this question, how's creation going on? Prabhupada mentions a purport. He says this other places too, but it's also here. Excuse me. In every inquisitive mind, the important question of the creation of the phenomenal world arises. In every inquisitive mind, the important question of the creation of the phenomenal world arises. And therefore, for a personality like Maharaj Parikshit, who was to know all the activities of the Lord from his spiritual master, such an inquiry is not uncommon. For every unknown thing, we have to learn and inquire from a learned personality. So Prabhupada's explaining, you know, we, it's important for us to know these things and to learn these things. And I was saying there's a similar point Prabhupada makes in the Bhagavad Gita in the 10th chapter, verse 7. Right? Krishna says, etam vibhutim yogam cha mama yo veti tatvataha so vikalpena yogena yujate natra samsaya. So Krishna says, one who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mind. So this is the 10th chapter, so opulence, the absolute, and he's describing so many things that represent him and so many things that are his powers. One who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mind engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this, there's no doubt. So, in other words, if we're not convinced of Krishna's mystic powers and opulence, we may not be able to be engaged in this unalloyed devotional service. So, Bhikshu Maharaj is saying, and Prabhupada's explaining, we need to know, our inquisitive mind wants to know the source of everything, wants to know how the Lord is present in the universe. And Krishna himself in the Gita says, if you know these things, then you can engage in unalloyed devotional service. And the purport, Prabhupada writes, the highest summit of spiritual perfection is knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Unless one is firmly convinced of the different opulences of the Supreme Lord, he cannot engage in devotional service. Generally, people know that God is great, but they do not know in detail how God is great. Here are the details. If someone knows factually how God is great, then naturally he becomes a surrendered soul and engages himself in the devotional service of the Lord. When one is firmly convinced of the opulence of the Lord, he accepts Krishna with great faith and without any doubt, and he engages in devotional service. All of this particular knowledge is required in order to increase one's interest in the loving devotional service of the Lord. One should not neglect to understand fully how great Krishna is, for by knowing the greatness of Krishna, one will be able to be fixed in sincere devotional service. So that's why these verses are here. And that's why Prakshat Maharaj is inquiring about them. And so it's important for us, as Prabhupada is explaining here, if we understand these opulences of the Lord, then we're inspired to surrender to him and to have faith in him. So then I was thinking, okay, so what exactly, because I remember reading different things, what exactly is this universal form that's being described? I remember traveling some places, I can't remember where, but some place, you hike up on some mountain or this or that, and there's, you know, some place the government puts out signs about whatever, and there was, here's the native people's myth about how these things were created. You know, there was a big eagle and she landed and she gave birth and it came out and there were the bears. How they have different ideas. And you know, modern people kind of read that like, wow, this is really nice to know what these other cultures thought about. You know, 50 years ago, nobody cared really. So it's nice we know about these different things. And isn't that a funny, interesting, cute story? That's how they look at it. Isn't that a cute story? Because, you know, we know that actually everything came about from, you know, a very scientific process of from nothing. Everything exploded for a reason we don't know, but that's what happened. Like, you know, 100 years from now, maybe less, Prabhupada's grace, people will be thinking, wow, listen to that cute story they used to believe in. Isn't that a cute story? Those people in the 20th and 21st century, weren't they cute? The way they believed all these funny little stories. So somebody might read this and think, wow, this is really cute, you know? You people really believe that like the clouds are on the hairs of God's body. That's cute. You know, that's really nice. Whereas we know something else. And of course, there's different opinions of people. Some more respectful the kind of traditional views and some not. So then the question arises, so what is this universal form? I mean, how are we supposed to understand these descriptions? You know, are the trees literally Krishna's hairs? You know, are the rivers literally the rivers? Are they, you know, I think described the veins. Thank you, the veins of the Lord, etc. Those descriptions are given. So this is from 2536, Prabhupada explains. Well, no, first the verse. Great philosophers imagine that the complete planetary systems in the universe are displays of the different upper and lower limbs of the universal body of the Lord. Purport. The word kalpayanti, or imagine, in quotes, is significant. The virat universal form of the Absolute is an imagination of the speculative philosophers who are unable to adjust to the eternal two-handed form of Lord Sri Krishna. Although the universal form, as imagined by the great philosophers, is one of the features of the Lord, it is more or less imaginary. The idea impressed herein is that the Supreme Lord is conscious of every part of his body, and nowhere in the creation is there anything beyond his control. And then back again to the Gita, who can guess which chapter? It's going to talk about similar things, about the universal form, chapter 11. And in the very beginning of Krishna showing his universal form, he tells Arjuna, you cannot see me, universal form, because he asked, show me how you're present here in the world. You cannot see me with your present eyes. Therefore, I give you divine eyes. Behold my mystic opulence. This just shows the beauty of the future of our movement. This 15-month-old child is sitting listening to Bhagavatam, totally absorbed. His grandfather's really trying to stay awake. There's hope for the future of our movement, isn't it? It's wonderful. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. A pure devotee does not like to see Krishna in any form except his form with two hands. A devotee must see his universal form by his grace, not with the mind, but with spiritual eyes. To see the universal form of Krishna, Arjuna is told not to change his mind, but his vision. The universal form, here's the other analysis or way of looking. The universal form of Krishna, Prabhupada says, anybody know what he says? What's coming up? The universal form of Krishna is not very important. I'm glad Prabhupada said it. I could not say that. I would be struck by lightning in a second. But Prabhupada says, the universal form of the Lord is not very important. That will be clear in subsequent verses. Yet, because Arjuna wanted to see it, the Lord gives him the particular vision required to see that universal form. The fact is that the devotee is not concerned with seeing the Vishvarupa, the universal form. But Arjuna wanted to see it to, remember why? To substantiate Krishna's statements so that in the future, people in Alatra and Bhagavatam class could understand that Krishna not only theoretically or philosophically presented himself as the Supreme, but he actually presented himself as such to Arjuna. The Lord gave Arjuna the necessary power to see his universal form because he knew Arjuna did not particularly want to see it, as we have already explained. Now you get in trouble. Yes, emphasize this point. Promise the fact that the devotee is not concerned with seeing the universal form. So devotees so aren't concerned to see the universal form. Promises is more or less imaginary in this Bhagavatam purport. Well then, why is it important? It's important for us. Why is it here? It's important. It's like you're saying, for the speculative philosophers, it's important that they begin to understand the Lord and how his energies are manifested in this world. And it's also important for us because it helps us understand the greatness of the Lord. And I live in the city, and like every 3 or 4 months, it's like, oh, it's a full moon. Or I think it's gonna be a full moon. Or I think it just was a full moon. And I'm staying back with the brahmacharis, and there's a guest room there. So every day I'm walking back and forth, and it's full moon. So it was like, wow, I didn't remember how bright you are, I'd forgotten. And you can really see a lot, which kind of made sense, like in history here, but all those people that launched wars on the dark moon night, or they fought through even those kind of things, it puts in context. And just seeing how, that moon is just, it's so impressive. And then, of course, the sun comes up. You walk back, and the sun's coming up right before class. And it's just a reminder of how vast and powerful Krishna is, like David Prasthas here and Padmamalini, former DC residents before Alachua, got another 2 Vaishnavas down here. But it was like this, who was that one guy? Ross Perot talked about his political thing, about the big vacuum sound of something. It was like the sound of people sneaking in the country or something. It's like Alachua, like all the Vaishnavas. Everybody's getting sucked to a latch. The temple's going to be empty around the world, North America. Everybody's coming here. But that's why the devotees in a latch have to make sure that the young couples have a lot of kids who then move back to the city, so it becomes mutual nourishment between all the temples. It's important. So grow him up, send him to D.C., okay? We need some there. So it's important for us to understand the Lord's greatness, because it evokes a sense of awe and reverence, which we just read. Devotees that only have awe and reverence, they can't understand the intimacy of Krishna. So that's there. But in our stage, if we don't understand awe and reverence of Krishna, we may not surrender to Krishna. That's a big, important reason for us to understand the Lord. It inspires us to surrender. And also for devotees, when we see how big he is, it's like, Krishna, I know you created the whole material world and all the universes and the sun and the moon and the stars, but I'm not sure if you can fix my problem. Right? And then it's like, well, you know, you got the sun up on time. Maybe you had a plan for me. You know, the moon is nurturing all life. Well, maybe, you know, there's hope for me. And you know, the earth is spinning and the seasons are changing, and I guess you're in control of stuff. You know, those kind of thoughts and those kind of realizations come. And then even more interesting along the lines of, you know, thinking in terms of Krishna as the source of this universal form, the wonderful mixtures of moods and rasas. Text 7, chapter 4, kindly describe how the Supreme Lord, who is all-powerful, engages his different energies and different expansions in maintaining and again winding up the phenomenal world in the sporting spirit of a player. So that comes back. He's controlling everything, but wow, he's so big, he's so great, he's sporting, it's Leela for him. Like Lord Varaha, right, dives to the bottom of the causal ocean like, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, sometimes people say, so like, you think the Lord comes like a boar? You're like, yeah, isn't that cool? Again, it's like, well, you people are really simple. The clouds are on the hairs, and the Lord God comes as a boar. You're like, yeah, isn't that amazing how vast he is? That he's so great, he's so big, like he says in the Gita. Arjuna, well, what use are these descriptions? It's just a spark of my splendor. Are you impressed yet? Can we go back to like what our relationship is here? You know, it's just a spark of my splendor. But for us, who, and for the world, and for the philosophers, and for the people in general, who get so caught up in their little worlds, like me in Rockville, like, oh wow, it's a full moon. I forgot there's a full moon in the world. Well, yeah, when you're out in the country, you notice these things. People get so caught up in their little problems, and their little world, and their little battles, and their little hatreds, and their little enviousness, and their little lust, and their little anger, and their little greed, because they've lost this bigger picture. But if people really see, as his descriptions there, see how small we are, it's not that important, and maybe I can connect with something more important. And Prabhupada says that there's so much frustration in the world because people, I think I mentioned this the other day, that they don't have a goal, they don't have a supreme, ultimate goal. But if you see there's this big thing, this big person puts everything in perspective. And I was thinking that nice story when in early days of Los Angeles Temple, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj, not a Maharaj at that point, I'm pretty sure, I believe he was appointed to be the temple commander, maybe the president, I think it was the temple commander, one of those really important positions that nobody 15 feet away from you pays much attention to once you step off the prop. But he had some big, big position. So he asked Prabhupada, he said, Prabhupada, something to this effect, paraphrasing, you know, if I get that big position, how do I not let it go to my head? You know, which is a nice question for a disciple as a spiritual master. So, you know, I can't quote the exact exchange, but something to effect that Prabhupada said, well, you know, here's one way you can meditate. There's a universe full of stars and planets, and within this big universe, there's one little tiny planet, which is Earth. And within that one planet of Earth, there's seven continents. And within one of those continents, there's the country, the United States. Within the United States, there's thousands of cities. And among those thousands of cities, there's one called Los Angeles. Within that city of Los Angeles, there's hundreds of streets. And on the one street called Waseca, there's dozens of houses. Within one of those houses, you're the boss. Yeah, you think you're very important, you know. They're like, okay, thank you, Prophet, for putting that in perspective for me. So in the same way, you know, these descriptions are there. You know, the sun and the moon are his eyes. The trees are like his hairs. The mountains are his bones. Like, wow, he's really great. I should surrender to him. He's so great, I should surrender him. And I think, and not only surrender him, but I think he can protect me. And I was saying, just like a little kid, you know, like your grandson is maybe, he's not yet at this point, but, you know, 3 or 4 years old, and you kind of have this sense, and probably also references this, the small child looks at their daddy and just thinks he's like the strongest person in the world. He'll protect me because he's big. He's like 3-4 times the size and, right, can pick them up like a feather. So that's Krishna. You know, that's God's position to us. He's so big. He's so powerful. And we can take shelter of him and put our cares at his feet. So this is a way we can meditate when these descriptions of the universal form. How great thou art, as our Christian friends say. This beautiful song, how great thou art. He's so great. He's so powerful. He's so, and we hear about the loving pastimes with Kartik season, and then we read about this universal form. And then another reflection, just to finish with, connected with the paper cup. Thank you, Prabhu. If we're thinking like this, if we're meditating on the universal form, if we're thinking that the trees are like the hairs of his body, and the rivers are like his veins, and the sun and the moon are like his eyes, and the surface of the globe, I think it said, is like his skin, then if we have that meditation, we have to be environmentalists. How can we mistreat a tree if we're hearing, if we're believing that they represent or they are like the hairs of his body? We can't harm trees like that. And it's one of the great crises that faces human society in this time, for sure, is the environmental crisis. I mean, hi, Bo, you're in Florida, right? Like, anybody notice down here? Environmental crisis, like, whoa, better not go 100 miles north. They're like, there goes our roof. All right, we're supposed to go through Tampa. Ramina's here, you know, everybody's, the whole country's thing, and Tampa's finished. I met, my chiropractor was telling me, they used to go to school in Tampa, and he said, I may never get back to Tampa. And you see all these pictures, like, here's the water, here's the lawn, and there's the mansion. And you just think, it's over. And for people outside of Florida, whoever heard of Fort Myers? Nobody's going to forget Fort Myers now. I mean, the destruction that was there was horrific. And almost everybody in the world is acknowledging these are man-made things. Thank you, ladies. You have no culpability for this one. They're man-made problems, you know? They're man-made problems. And people know what needs to be done. A lot of it, we know what needs to be done. You know, I mean, stop chopping down the Brazilian rainforest, but they can't, because there's too much money and too much power and too much, you know, very, very crazy, sinful people involved. But if we're understanding that actually the planet is Krishna's. It's you know, Bhumi is here. She's a personality, and it's Krishna's energy, and ultimately it's all Krishna. And the universal form is there. The trees, the mountains, they're all manifestations of him, of the Lord, of my Lord. I don't want to harm. Why would I do any harm? Say if you have a child, if you love your child, you know, if you have a bad day, you don't come home and tear up your kid's coloring book, you know? You don't, like, when you're depressed, you, like, don't walk in and mess up their room. I mean, what kind of insane person would do that? So in the same way, I mean, human society is upset about so many things. But you don't trash the planet if you see the connection, especially if you see the connection with the Lord. And just like there was a story connected to the, I guess it was Fort Myers, you might have seen it, some guys, probably dozens of stories like this. But some man, there was a big flood, and his mother was, I think, wheelchair-bound, if I remember correctly. And he swam like a half a mile to get to her at great risk. And he was able to, like, put her up on a table and then on top of another table, just high enough so she survived. Again, there's probably dozens of stories. This is just one I saw. And, you know, it was like newsworthy that he made this big sacrifice. Well, why did he make that big sacrifice? Because he loved his mom, you know? And he loved his mom. So he put his whole life at risk just to go to save his mother. So people made sacrifices for things that they care for. And if this world is dead matter, you know, if it's just came out of nothing or came out of chemical combinations, then who cares? It's just, if I'm just here for like a few years, and if there's no controller, if there's no reason for everything, just like recently I read some article about how they're reintroducing bison in a lot of places around the country. And I think there was down to like, there were like 75 American buffalo left at some point in time. It was really, really, maybe it was a couple hundred. And now they're gradually increasing more and more. And now they're starting to say they want to reintroduce the buffalo because it has such a positive effect on the rest of the environment. Even like they're saying, like their hoofs put, you know, I would think, well, they're going to crush the grass. But no, their hoofs make an imprint. And I guess the dew, or when it rains, it catches in the hoof print. And then certain organisms and insects that can grow, which causes this and causes this and causes that. It's all interconnected. But the history, why they almost all get killed? One reason was because when they first made, one of the contributing factors when they first made trains, and it was sport. Wasn't the ladies, I don't think. Maybe there was one or two. Maybe Annie Oakley did this. I'm not sure her history. But they would like drive by, you know, huge herds of buffalo, and they would just shoot them like target practice out of the trains. And you know, the native people, their lives depended on the buffalo for many different things. And the environment, now we're learning, depended on that. But they didn't, there was no vision. Wow, target practice. So people driving down the street, throwing the trash out the window and building a factory that pollutes the planet and not caring about this and not caring about that and what's my carbon footprint, who cares? They're like the buffalo killers. They're like modern day buffalo hunters. They're just shooting out of the train without thinking about what's the impact. So one other practical reason, just like I was singing during Tulsi Puja this morning, it's like really far out. Like, I don't know if there's any other. Sometimes like you drive by in D.C. I saw the other day, a blessing to the animals. Come to church and bless the animals. You know, and afterwards stay for breakfast. You know, ham and eggs after breakfast, you know, at the church or something. That part I added, but that's what they all do. So what good is your blessing the animals, and then we all know this, and then you all kill the animals. So in the same way, you know, it's interesting, you come to like our temples, and every morning we worship a plant. I mean, that's really far out. You know, I've heard some like scholars of the environment, that they like, well, the Hare Krishnas worship plants. They love it. Makes their heart melt. They wish everybody would worship plants, you know. But we worship, but we can't really worship Tulsi, but then go out and, you know, and don't have some respect for her cousins, you know, some way for other. So it's just another benefit. It's just another benefit of that, you know, there's this mentality to use and abuse the world. But actually, if we understand, if we meditate in a universal form, through that, we not only awaken our surrender to Krishna, our devotion to Krishna, our affection for Krishna, but as a byproduct, we collect the plant. We protect the planet. It's like, you know, eating only Krishna prasadam. As a byproduct, it's more healthy. As a byproduct, it's better for the planet. So all these wonderful things. So just a few of your thoughts on the universal form and how even tough verses can have like some really nice insights for all of us. So thank you for listening. We got a few minutes, so there's some questions. Anybody might like to ask? Yes, Prabhu. Yeah, please.
thank you for your class, first of all. Very inspiring. And one of the things that was in one of the purports you read was that electricity comes from the nails of the Lord.
Yeah.
Which is something that I either forgot or I didn't remember one of the two. But I've been watching this series, Krishna series. It's called Ramananda Sagar's Krishna. It's a very, very extensive series. There's like 55 DVDs.
Wow.
And when he shows Krishna fighting with demons like Narkasura and all these things, sometimes Krishna like throws out some electricity and all the troops that he was fighting fall down. And you can see the electric charge. And I was thinking, because he has a bunch of different references, including Prabhupada's books, that he uses for this series. But I thought, well, God.
Maybe he read this verse.
Well, that's what I, you know, because I was wondering, I was thinking, Krishna is electrifying through electricity, these things, and I forgot. And then you mentioned it, and now I understand why he put that in the series.
Yeah,
because right, electricity comes from his
neck. The hairs on his head and face are the reservoirs for the clouds, and his nails are the breeding ground of electricity.
Also, one of the comments is that Prabhupada said in many places, if somebody claims they are God, they should show the universal form to prove it. So, although the universal form is not that great,
although I've seen a lot of people with scattered hair and weird things coming out their mouths, and you know, so
there are. But not the universal.
There are a few people that have semblance of the universal form.
Yeah.
Yeah. We see more of that as time passes in Kali Yuga.
So, that's although it's not very important for us, they still can't do it.
Yeah.
They can't even reach up to that level doing it. Although Krishna is so much greater than the universal form. Sorry about my
Thank
voice.
You. Thank you, Prabhu. Thank you.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu, thank you. I'm just puzzling over the difference with how the universal form is presented in the Bhagavatam, and Prabhupada says it's basically imaginary. And then what Krishna gives in chapter 11 of Bhagavad Gita, it seems to be related to the battlefield experience, that the universal form. And Arjuna needs divine eyes to see it. But here maybe there's two different versions of the universal form.
Well, there's also the universal form, one version of the universal form that Krishna showed to Duryodhana, right? When they tried to kidnap him. Krishna went as the peace mission. And Prabhupada comments that he says in the Gita, no one's seen this form before, and he mentions that this was a different display than Duryodhana didn't get to see the whole thing. But Prabhupada also mentions in here, maybe I read a different purport, but did I read this section where Prabhupada says it's a imaginary, and then he also says, because I know Ravindra Stroop likes to quote this all the time, that Prabhupada says, the devotee's not very interested in a godless display of opulence, which is kind of like Prabhupada's ecstasy got like carried away, because like, what does he mean there, you know? That the universal form is a godless display of opulence. I don't understand that, but it's really interesting he says that, you know? So devotee wants, and then, because Arjuna comes back and just wants to see Krishna in his two-handed form. So.
Well, then Krishna also showed the universal form to Mother Yashoda, you know, within his mouth.
Yes, yes. That's his playful nature, isn't it? He likes to show that now and then. He's really far out. Yes, for me, approval.
Hare Krishna. Well, thank you. Just wondered if you had any comment, you know, like we take seriously the protection of the environment. But, you know, we've heard that the scientists say that, well, one of the causes of deterioration in the environment is you have too many cows. Mm. And now in Europe, there's a whole thing where they say the farmers are growing too many of the wrong kind of vegetables, so they're making it illegal to own land.
They're doing what with the land?
Illegal to own land, the government's.
It's illegal to own land?
Yeah, I think it's in the Netherlands.
I haven't heard that before.
Netherlands, maybe?
Wow. That's right up there with the seeds that are so good, they don't produce more seeds.
Yeah.
I mean, if there was ever a script for a sci-fi horror film, you know, I mean, right out of the Gita, right? The demons, they engage in horrible, unbeneficial acts meant to destroy the world. I mean, what better way to destroy the world than to produce some kind of food that doesn't produce seeds? And then you have to, of course, you know, I don't like this word, but I mean, that's demoniac. Then you got to come back, the farmers have to come back and buy seeds from the people that have the seeds, and then they can't keep their own seeds. And then now, I've read some things like some of those seeds that don't reproduce seeds blow into the fields of the others. I mean, it's like a perfect sci-fi horror film. It's like, that's it. That's the end of it. We're done.
They get sued for growing seeds that are cut. They don't know.
they get sued. So then the legal system comes in. And then it mixes, and then eventually maybe those seeds become barren. And then, you know, at some point there's no food. I mean, you were eating tree bark.
And they take it one step further, is that they make these seeds that won't reproduce, so that you can pour all kinds of chemicals and poisons on the ground and the plant will still grow and then suck that off and then we eat it and become sick.
Yeah. The seed is patented with, it comes with its own pesticide.
It's patented as a pesticide.
The seed is patented as a pesticide. That's where food comes from. Yeah.
Darn. And they don't have to tell you that this is what you're
progress.
Buying.
Yeah, like the Dow Chemical, when I was a kid, their motto was better life through chemicals. Remember that? Better life through chemicals. Any questions or comments from the... Okay, one more here. Anybody over there?
I think a while back there was a resolution in GBC that Styrofoam should be banned in our movement.
That was banned?
Styrofoam was banned in our movement. Because it takes forever.
Yeah, I think there was. And there's all kinds of debates. There's certain kinds that aren't supposed to be so bad. But yeah, there are resolutions like that. And there's a program now called the ISKCON Environmental Movement. If you look up ISKCONenvironment.org, you can find more about it, trying to help green all the temples in many different ways. Food, waste, energy, culture, and water. Those five areas, and looking like three tiers. So. It would be really, I think Alachua is ahead of a lot of temples already, but it'd be nice if we could do even better. So you may want to look at that and others as well. And we're looking for devotees who want to help with that initiative. So if you go online and find some interest there, we need devotees to help with that. ISKCONenvironment.org. Yeah. Question?
In regards to the universal form, you were using the word imaginary.
Prabhupada used the word imaginary.
You're right. You were quoting.
Yes, thank you.
The word imaginary. And one step. Yeah. So in the third chapter of the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam,
okay,
we were reading yesterday, there's a verse that actually says it's false. And in retrospect, I wish I had stopped and tried to figure out how to think about that, because there's so much about the universal form in the Bhagavad Gita, and, you know, showed the universal form to Madhya Yashoda. So do you want to kind of try to just wrap that up a little bit? How do we think about that, or how do we explain that?
Prabhupada said it is false, or he said more or less falser.
The text. The third chapter. Does anybody know that verse?
Who's
speaking?
In
the third chapter of the first canto, maybe in 20.
It specifically said the universal form is false.
It's false. I wish we had the.
I would understand that since the universe is false.
Universal form.
Yeah, well, I would understand that since the universe is false, in the ultimate sense, it's temporary. It's here now, it's gone tomorrow. So the same way, you know, that it's an energy of Krishna's, that the energy is not false, material energy is not false because its form is always changing. In the ultimate sense, it's false, that it's not permanent. In that sense, that true means it's permanent, means it's eternal, like the soul is eternal. You know, the body's not. So
thank you.
That's how I would
thank
understand
you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Forgive me, thank you for the class, but if you already mentioned and I missed it, but Prabhupada explains how this chapter, the first step in God realization, that's it, that's the title of the chapter.
No, this chapter is two, right? Purusha Shukta confirmed.
Oh, okay.
I think the first chapter one is the first step in God realization.
Yes, so... Yeah. Begins to explain the universal form, like the...
Well, that's what's so amazing. It starts out the first step in God realization, and it talks a little about the universal manifestation there, and then it goes on to the Lord in the heart, and it talks about the yogis, and then from there the third chapter is pure devotional service, and it's just all about bhakti and just surrender to God. And then it goes back to creation, which is why it's interesting. Why does it do that? Why doesn't it stop? Well, that's that whole question, because we need to be convinced and understood and educated, so we want to surrender, we need to surrender, and we're inspired to surrender.
Yeah, and the first chapter the first step in God realization, Prabhupada explains that this universal form that's described is the first step in God realization to help us meditate on a personal form, although it's imaginary. But for people on the like impersonal level, they get an understanding of a bodily form of the Lord. So
thank you. Yeah, that's a big important part of it. Thank you. Anybody else? Oh, thank you.
The scientists and the media, rightly so, they focus on the carbon problem, but they really miss the sinful reaction problem, you know, and how much that plays a part in the whole environmental
issue. Yeah, back to Ramiya's point about, you know, methane gas, it's like, I think that's a big part, right? The cows produce methane gas, but I've never seen like a chart of how much comes from cows, so maybe there is a lot of methane gas, but I would think there's probably not a big problem if you get rid of a lot of the other sources of methane gas. That's just one response.
Yeah, within that chapter, I think Brahman was telling Nara that without the universal form, then nothing can exist in this world. Mm. You know, it has that Virat Purusha has to manifest force. It's the process of creation, and then, you know, everything comes like that, you know. So yeah. It seems like it has some significance, right?
Yeah, oh, definitely a significance. Yeah, definitely. Okay, thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.